ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Sarga, really. Chapter 9. So we're up to text 5. Answers by citing the Lord's version. Excuse me. You didn't do 4. Okay. Good. No, there we go. Now, okay. Right. Such a big lunch. Yeah. I'm more than usually handicapped here. Let me just talk a little bit about something we discussed yesterday. It's kind of a tangent, but then on the other hand it's not, and that's about the nature of time, which is really a third canto issue. It comes up here. Especially with reference to... I drew this little thing on the board, you know, that came up with the fall of the Jiva issue. How, you know, while so many millions of years going on down here, Rama has one day up here, and the structure of time is sort of like this, and it presumably kind of come to a peak, and this is where Brahman is, right? Everything becomes one, in the sense that there is what people call an eternal now. So there's at least in Western religious thought for a long time, there was a difference between time and eternity. It wasn't just eternity, it wasn't eternal duration, but rather the absence of time, which is usually conceived as an eternal instant. And according to that view, which Ujjamani talks about, comes from... Did I spell that right? Boethius? Anyway, a Christian thinker. But there's a standard idea, this idea that God doesn't, for God there's no past or future, he sees everything at once. And so this notion that there's a predestination problem or everything, because it just doesn't apply to God. Right? And this is, eternity is conceived in this version is something static. Nothing happens. But what we learn, which is quite surprising to people of Western backgrounds, is that in eternity, things are constantly increasing. Krishna is always increasing. So it's dynamic and not static. Something's going on. If things are increasing, that means there has to be some kind of transcendental time. Or things are going along. And Prabhupada says there is time in the spiritual world that has no power to control activities. So from that point of view, then I begin to look at this notion too. And there's another view of time, not that where everything is sort of fixed from all eternity, past, present, and future. And this is the notion that the future is objectively fuzzy, and that when Krishna says I know everything, past, present, and future, you could say he knows the future as the future, which is not quite determined. Rather, the future exists as a series of possibilities, and then when some body, either Krishna or Jiva, makes a decision of a free will, then it becomes fixed, because that's when you make those decisions is called the present. Right. That's the other view of time. Now the reason I was started to take this view seriously was sometime in the early 70s here in Mayapur, Prabhupada started to talk about a future nuclear war between the United States and Russia. And he was quite specific. It was coming soon, and it would start as a war between India and Pakistan, and then, according to the Cold War alliances, the United States would come in on the side of Pakistan, and Russia would come in on the side of India, and there would be a nuclear war. And Prabhupada was quite into it. And of course, the devotees loved this stuff, and every morning walk, you know, we'd hear what he said today, you know. And some GBCs went off and started building fallout shelters, and survivalist mentality came to the fore in some places. And it was quite a thing, because Prabhupada was talking about it. In the event of a year or so passes and nothing happens, there's no war. And when I asked some GBCs I knew, what did Prabhupada say? And they told me, I didn't hear this from Prabhupada directly, that Krishna changed his mind. And that's when I thought, okay, there was one future, which based on the accumulated karma of all the people, that there would be this nuclear war to discharge it, all this bad karma, and that Krishna changed his mind. And therefore the future was now going to be different, because Krishna changed his mind. So that's when I began to take this view seriously, and then I thought, can God change his mind? Because maybe from this classical theological view, the Boethian view, he can't. It's all one thing, you know? He just stuck. So that's why I began to think of this. And then I wondered why Krishna changed his mind. And then a few years later, we had some Soviet devotees come to Mayapur for the first time. And I happened to talk to a bunch of them who had spent time on a collective farm in Georgia, the real Georgia, the Soviet Georgia. It was a massive orchard of fruit trees. Down there, there were I guess oranges and things like that, and grapefruit. And these fruit in the Soviet days were not available only to a certain group of people, the nomenklatura, you know, the party officials and things like that. Nobody else got them. Anyway, they would be told when there was a meeting of the Politburo, that the steering committee of the Communist Party. They would be told to pack up so many crates of these fruit for the members of the Politburo for their meeting. So they would collect all the fruit together, go to a remote corner of the orchard, pile, put it on a big pile, offer it to Krishna, have a kirtan, and pack it up and send it. That's why Krishna changed his mind. I don't know for sure, but it seems to me this is why would people's karma change so drastically? And, you know, the whole Gorbachev called the whole thing off. There was somebody could figure out why he did it. Maybe he ate a lot of those prasadam grapefruit or whatever. Anyway, that's why I was thinking like that. So when we discuss the nature of Vaikuntha and the spiritual world, the very significant thing is that it's always increasing because there's dynamics. By the way, Christianity theology has a contradiction in it. They kind of accept this classical view of time and eternity. Yet, where Christianity has this idea that, to me, is a more Vaishnava idea, that the Godhead, they have three people, right? The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, in a relationship with each other. Now, we know there's a lot more than that. But there's a dynamic, in Christian theology, there's a dynamic going on. in that relationship. And if you, what I've seen of the writings on that, they don't come anywhere close to what you see in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, things like that. But anyway, that to me is a more Vaishnava idea of transcendence as being alive and vital and growing and so on. So I just wanted to bring that up. The other thing I wanted to mention, in the verse, Prabhupada talks about that when the soul becomes established in its own position, what there is a restoration of a relationship with Krishna, and therefore a restoration of service. With that restoration of relationship with Krishna, I understand who I am, that I am the servant, that I am not God, and the way this looks is the end of mamaham of all kinds, the elimination of the false ego and the true ego. So people try by various processes to get rid of the ego some way or another in the impersonalist thing, but they have no notion of a relationship. But once one understands what the root of my false ego is, that it's aversion to the service of Krishna, rebelliousness against God, turning away from God, then you can, then when that relationship with Krishna is understood, because I become, a person is a social being. To say God is a person is to say that God is social. Prabhupada said you'll never see Krishna by himself. He's always in the association of his devotees. And to say we are people, we are also social. And what our personality is, it's only manifest or even develops in relationship with other persons. So in response to a relationship with Krishna, our own authentic self becomes disclosed. And that authentic self is always characterized by this absence of mama and aham. Because Krishna is the center of the enjoyment, and I'm the servant of Krishna. So this humility, and devotee should develop naturally as a consequence of the relationship. Prabhupada once remarked, he said, "Don't be puffed up. Remember, you are dealing with Krishna." So anyone who becomes proud has to forget who's really big and who's really important and who's really interesting and whose servant I am. Any other questions on yesterday? Yeah?
I was just about this, these two theories about Krishna's knowing the future. I'm wondering if they are necessarily irreconcilable.
They may, yeah.
What came to mind is the way Prabhupada translates the first verse of Bhagavatam, where Krishna knows everything directly and indirectly. It seems that, his knowledge of the future could also have this direct and indirect components to it, and in that way have two, he has, it seems like he would be able to then have two different ways of knowing the future.
Could be. Follow it up. The hypothesis, right? This is something that, this kind of two distinct ideas of time articulated that way, it's something you see now in Western philosophy. And the question is, if you go back and read the previous acharyas, some people, without actually naming it or saying it, will have that idea, and you can see if it's there. Okay, now we go on, text 4. I have it up here for you. So now, having answered this question about the how did the soul come into contact with the material energy What's his nature there? We now, he says, turn to Brahma. And remember there was a question about how does the body of Brahma differ from that of Krishna and so on. But now also we begin to tell a story. Right? First three verses are quite strictly philosophical. Now he says, the personality of Godhead, being very pleased with Lord Brahma because of his non-deceptive penance in bhakti yoga, presented his eternal and transcendental form before Brahma, and that is the objective goal of purifying the conditioned soul. The objective goal for purifying the conditioned soul is the first line, atma-tattva-vishuddhi-artham. Artham means goal, and it also means the object, like a sense object is called an artha, indriya-artha. So you can say it's the subject. That brings about this vishuddhi, the purification. And what does it? Atma tattva. Of course, atma here, the purport means both atmas. We do it in English, atma with a little a and atma with a big a. No, we don't do that. We do self with a small s and self with a big s. We don't do it in Sanskrit. The self and the self of all selves. So it says here that he was showed his form, his rupa, by showing darshan. Here's the word darshan. We have the word darshan, either to see or to make yourself visible. And then because of this Avyalika Vrata Ajitaha. Vrata means a vow. In the Bhagavad Gita, Dritta Vrataha. Ajita means worship with his vow. And the word here is non-deceptive. Non-deceptive. Avyalika means without any hypocrisy. And really in the context of Krishna consciousness, it means particularly without any ulterior motive. If we are in the path of Krishna consciousness that's laid out by Mahaprabhu and the Six Goswamis, it is the path of pure devotional service. Now, one does not have to be a pure devotee, in the sense of perfected, to be on the path of pure devotional service, but the qualification is anya-bilasita-shunyam. One cannot be practicing devotional service for some other thing. As soon as I am practicing devotional service for some material goal, that's called deceptive. Then it's kaitava dharma. It's not pure because I'm doing it, but I have some other thing in mind. Karma and jnana, one of those two kinds of the realm of, as Prabhupada described before, of mama and aham. So that's what it's meant. So Brahma was he simply wanted to serve the Lord. And that's what's meant by, and his vrata was simply to do that. I mean, it'll explain here a little later on about that. Yeah.
So again, in the path of pure devotional service, if one has ulterior motive, is he on the path but not mature?
Well, it depends. To have material desires, you can be on the path. It's you, how you deal with those desires. If you're trying to satisfy them by what you're doing, then you're doing something else. And you're not really very qualified. You can, in the very beginning, it's not understood yet, maybe. Sometimes this is what a Kanishtha Adhikari is like. He has only the minimum qualification for the path of devotional service. Is attracted to it, but still is. But the main thing is that not that I have these desires, but that do I want to fulfill them, or am I trying to get rid of them? So it's my attitude toward my own desires. That's what makes the difference. So naturally, we're full of material desires. But I'm on the path and moving progressively if I am trying sincerely to become free from them. Maybe I may not be as successful as I want to be, but still I don't give up in my determination in spite of setbacks of one kind or another. This is the vrata. Once I compromise and say, okay, you know, look, nobody can do it. I'm a married guy, you know, we do this thing. Who knows what the sannyasis are doing? But we don't really know. Once I develop a mentality like that, then everything comes to a stop. Yeah. Because then usually I start finding fault with other people or become the savior of the cows or something. I'll find some other way to build myself up. Okay, so he says, Atma Tattva, the science of both, God and the living entity. Paramatma and the Jivatma, the two Atmas. Prabhupada says that Sukadev Goswami explains this verse with the aim of purifying the truth. He says, this is an interesting phrase, purifying the truth of both the Paramatma and the Jivatma. So the wrong conception to the Jivatma to identify with the material body, with the pure soul, and Paramatma to think he's on the equal level with the living entity. So here he's recapping. Both misconceptions can be removed. So here this theme that occurs all the time, how Prabhupada says, puts it this way, God realization and self realization go together. It's simultaneous. And here the example is there. When you see the sun, then you can see yourself and you can see everything else. This is how we find out who we are. We do not find out who we are, really. Until we're in a relationship with God. Because what we are without relationship with God, that's a dream. That's a false self. Like the dreamer seeing his body in a dream. Right? That's the first verse. And here, notice how, this is typical of Prabhupada, notice how he has this word deceptive in here, because he used it in there. Any other method for realizing Atma Tattva, aside from Bhakti Yoga, will prove to be deceptive. You're being misled. So here's Brahma's penance now, and we're going to hear about it in Bhakti Yoga. And the result, he was able to see the transcendental form of the Lord. How do you see a transcendental form? How do you see the form of one who has no form? So that's what's going to come up. And he says here, his transcendental form is 100% spiritual. And one can see him only by spiritualized vision. proper discharge of tapasya or penance in pure bhakti yoga. There's some simple examples that Prabhupada uses to explain this. He says, if you want to enter into the fire, you have to become fire. So if you want to approach Krishna or spirit, you have to become spiritual. Otherwise, the contrast keeps you out. And again, Prabhupada gives the example, when we say spiritualized, he described the process of bhakti yoga as like taking a piece of iron and putting it into a fire. Now the iron is not fire. So the bodies that we have here right now that we do Krishna consciousness are definitely material bodies. I have this body because I wanted sense gratification. This body is actually our body, our personality. All of it is made for the avoidance of Krishna. So it's material. And we have misused our senses for so long. But now we engage our senses in Krishna's service. That means coming into contact with fire. You put an iron in a fire, it starts to become hot. And then finally red hot, it glows cherry red. And then for all practical purposes, it's fire. You can light other things with it, and so on. For all practical purposes. So Prabhupada said that a devotee who's serving Krishna 100%, that devotee's body is he called it a spiritualized material body. For all practical purposes, even though you're in this world and there's all the inconveniences of material existence, they do not interfere with the service for Krishna in any way. Prabhupada compared this to a gold-plated box. One would assume that the body one has in the spiritual world is pure gold. But here you have a gold-plated box. For all practical purposes, as good as pure gold. But it will grow old, and you'll have to shuffle off the mortal coil like everybody else. But still, that does not interfere at all or interrupt the activities of devotional service. Now this is the re-spiritualization of matter. So otherwise, Krishna is invisible. In the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, there's one verse that says, Nam Chintamani Krishnas Chitanya Rasa Vigraha. What is it called? Nityam Shudam Purna Shudam Nityamukta Abhinatva Nama Namanama. That it describes that Krishna, the name is identical with Krishna. There's no difference between the name and the and that which is named. So therefore, the name of Krishna is Chintamani, I guess we could say, full of spiritual opulences. The form of all spiritual rasas, complete, pure, transcendent, because it is Krishna. Name of Krishna, Krishna's name are the same. Therefore, then the next verse after that, in Bhakti, this is the sequence, Atashi Krishna Namha Di Namba Vedrayam Indra. Therefore, because you ask the question, well, if that's true, why when I chant the Hare Krishna mantra, don't I experience this, Purna Shuddha Nityamukta Namana Chintamani, Chitanya Rasa Vigraha, why don't I experience it? Because our senses cannot grasp Krishna's Nam Adi, his name, etc. That means the Adi is a well-known sequence, beginning with the name. Name, nama, rupa, guna, and lila. They're just inaccessible to us. Why? Because we have our senses are materially contaminated and therefore have become incapacitated. They've lost their power to see Krishna. The eyes are meant for seeing Krishna, but we've done things like open the centerfold in Playboy magazine or something, you know, and they've lost seeing so many things, you know. So all the senses being used for sense gratification. Although originally our senses are meant for serving Krishna, we've turned them to a different use, and so they lose their power. How do we regain that power? Sevan mukhe, with the attitude of a service, beginning with this tongue. Here's another adi, jiva. Beginning with the tongue. The tongue and all the other senses. The tongue is kind of the center because it's both a karmindriya and a gyanindriya. It's both a knowledge acquiring sense by the sense of taste and a karmindriya by sound production. So the tongue with all these senses, swayam egos, paraktyataha, then they become capable. Now the question is, for us anyway, so if Krishna is inaccessible to my senses, but my senses can be purified by engaging with Krishna, how do they do that to begin with? And that is, the answer to that is, Krishna has kindly given us ways of coming into contact with Him, even with our contaminated senses. The Hare Krishna mantra, the deity in the temple, Srimad Bhagavatam, prasadam, so on. These are all ways that even though we cannot perceive spirit, we can come into contact with spirit. But what we have to say is that we do not know the meaning of these things. Here he says here, the form of Krishna, Lord, the form of Lord manifested before Brahma is not one of the forms which we have experienced in the material world. Well, wait a minute. There he is, two hands, blue, you know, holding a fruit. I've seen, you know, I can see that in the material world. But obviously, I've not seen. So I cannot actually understand. When Brahma tells us, you know, Shaimam Dribongalalita Niyata Prakasham, you know, when he describes Krishna, we can understand the words, we can imagine what they say, his garland, his moon locket, his flute, his threefold bending form. But at the same time, if I see that, if I really understand those words, I should see Krishna. His form is Shyamasunga Achintya Guna Swarupam. He's dark blue. Shyam means dark blue and beautiful. Now, but we understand that this blue of Krishna is different from the material blue. What is that? Any idea? Well, we know he's dark blue and he also is at the same time light because it's like a monsoon cloud with lightning within, so it's a kind of radiant darkness. We get a little idea of that, but beyond that, what is this spiritual blue? Well, the only way that you can know what this spiritual blue is by seeing it, just as if you were colorblind. You'll never know what a blue is or how it differs from green. You can only know it by experience. People could say, well, you know, blue is cool and green is this. Give some examples, you know, with parallels to other senses, but you can't do it. But Nevertheless, because these words, like Krishna mantra, do not come from the material world. They come from the spiritual world. If we bring our senses into contact with them in the right manner, our senses become purified. And when they become purified, we'll begin to understand. We'll begin to understand what we are reading and what we are saying gradually, and see Krishna by spiritualized vision, just like Lord Brahma. So there's a process, this tapasya, that we'll talk about this tapasya in here. But that's really what goes on in Krishna consciousness. We bring our senses into contact with Krishna through the ways provided. And if we do this with a firm vow, our senses become purified and Krishna appears.
How much different is the process of bhakti yoga that Ramaji undertook to what we're doing today nowadays?
Prabhupada just describes it as bhakti yoga. Right? He doesn't really mention how different it is. He was under different circumstances, however, and he was sitting on a lotus flower, and he was the only guy. So sankirtan, in the sense of doing it with many people, was out of the question.
There was no
mridanga. Huh? Nothing was made yet. So in that thing, in the second canto, earlier in this canto, Prabhupada describes those people who go up, he calls them mystic bhakti yogis somewhere in those purports. Remember where the ones that rise up and go past all the planets and they leave their body at the right time, is described how to leave the body. Prabhupada calls them bhakti yogi, but they're mystic bhakti yogis. They perform a kind of ashtanga yoga or some kind of physical yoga, but in devotional service. So it seems that Brahma was doing something like that. But it's the same idea. I mean, the principle of yoga is to concentrate the mind by controlling the senses. Now the thing with this is you can't, there's no deity, so you can't look at the deities. but at least the mind can become purified. And what Brahma had to meditate on is a mantra. The 18-syllabled Krishna mantra. Not in this text, in the Brahma Samhita.
No, but I'm saying in this context, is that not a different...
Well, Prabhupada, you'll notice he conflates the two accounts. Mm-hmm. He says he was initiated and there was a mantra. And there was a mantra. He was giving something to meditate on. In the Brahma Samhita, it's very clear that he's given a Krishna mantra. Here he sees Vishnu. But there was some mantra.
But the question of the devotional service that he performs leading up to his seeing Vishnu.
It was meditation or japa. Japa in the strictest sense of the term.
Right. But what is being said here is that because he was performing devotional service, therefore he got the opportunity to see Vishnu.
Yes, that's right.
And so did he have that mantra before meeting Vishnu?
Did he have that what?
The mantra?
No, he heard it from an unseen...
But that's...
From within the heart, right?
Right, did that mean the 18-syllable Gopal mantra, or...?
Well, in one time and place it did.
Okay.
What in this particular case, what exact mantra he got, I don't know. But we'll see when Prabhupada gets to this, he just talks about being initiated with a mantra. And the one mantra we know about is the 18-syllable Gopal mantra, whereupon he saw Goloka Vrindavan. Here he goes to Vaikuntha. So on this particular, I guess it's a different kalpas. It was a different place. Yeah.
Earlier in this canto, it was described in the 18-letter mantra, the Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Even though I tried to count that, and it didn't make sense to me. But it describes Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Yeah. First of all, the Om doesn't count.
It doesn't.
Does it count? Okay. So if it counts, then what is it? How many?
Well, I counted 720.
Huh? For the Gopal mantra.
Letters mean syllables.
Even when conjoined.
Akshara is a syllable.
Yeah, Akshara means syllable. In Sanskrit, a letter is a vowel plus whatever comes in it precedes it.
So it's
17.
That's the 17 syllable mantra.
17.
It says 18?
Yeah, I'll try that.
My understanding of this passage is that Brahma was bewildered and the mantra you're referring to that he heard from an unseen source is Tapa.
No, this will be clear. We'll get to this. From this account, it seems first he heard Tapa, then he got a mantra. Tapa was not actually the mantra, that was. Also the form of the Lord was sound, but as instruction.
So he got the instructions to do Tapa, and
then he got a mantra. Right? That's at least what seems to be Prabhupada's account. We'll go over that and make sure we're right about this. We call it 18 literature.
There's a
residence
in Narada
Dhruva. Yeah, Narada Dhruva, right, we know that one.
And it says composed of 18 letters. Anyway, somehow.
Alright, well.
Yeah, that's a separate problem.
This, in our way, really has no practical bearing on our practice of Krishna consciousness. So we can just leave this for later. So here in the purport, Prabhupada has been at pains to distress the distinction between the form of the Lord and the form of the conditioned soul. And by the process of bhakti yoga, he says right here, one can understand this difference. So after Brahma understands these things, then he's told by the Lord the gist. Prabhupada used the word gist. Means a quick summary of Srimad Bhagavatam in four original verses. The verses are the origin of Srimad Bhagavatam. And so, see, the thing about Bhagavatam, it does not originate in the material world. It comes down, it's descending. The sound of Srimad Bhagavatam is transcendental. And the resonance, he uses this word resonance, of Srimad Bhagavatam is as good as that of the Vedas. So here Prabhupada is just summarizing here. So now we will continue. Okay. Now here Brahma, who's called Adideva and Paraha Guru, of the first demigod of the universe, or the guru, I don't know, but he's a guru too. He could not trace out the source of his lotus seat. You just imagine, he kind of comes to consciousness, and he's sitting on this lotus. Here I am, and looks down, and he can't see that he stem apparently disappears in the darkness.
Scary,
right? And while thinking of creating the material world, so he had this impulse to do something, to create, That would seem to be innate. He could not understand the proper directions for creative work, nor could he find out the process for creation. What is this word, propulsion? Is that this material in the sense of the materials for creation? You know? The word for word, propuncha.
Propuncha just means the phenomenon of the universe.
Huh?
Propuncha generally means just the phenomenon of the universe.
The phenomenon, yeah.
Next slide.
Yeah, just what it's interesting. So here, this is his situation. Prabhupada refers to this verse as the prelude.
Propuncha just means.
The process of construction, yeah. Material world, okay.
Yeah, it means the material world.
Okay.
Isn't there something to do with five elements in the puncha? Puncha?
No.
No, it's different. It's different. So it's explaining between two things, the transcendental nature of the form and the abode of the Lord. So he will see the abode first, and then find make contact with the Lord in his abode. So he sees both of these things factually. So such knowledge of the spiritual sky can be known only by dint of devotional service of bhakti yoga. So two things, his knowledge of this transcendence and the power of creation was also achieved by bhakti yoga. Notice this, the ability to act in the world in devotional service or in the proper way, the direction, is also given by bhakti yoga. Brahmaji was bewildered in the matter of creation and he could not even trace out the source of his own existence. Where did I... So here we are. I mean, to me, this is like an image of any conditioned soul. Sometime, I don't know, around the age of 3 or 4 years old, maybe 2 or 3 years old, we kind of wake up. And suddenly we're in this world, right? How did we get here? What am I doing here? Why am I in this body? It's just weird. We're just thrown in and we find ourselves in a situation. And we've got no idea how I arrived here, what am I doing here, and so on. And we can't, when I was a little kid, I tried to ask this question, but nobody could understand me. I mean, I wonder, why was I in this family rather than that family? You know, why was I in this body rather than that body? Because the whole thing was just spooky. You're thrown in, and there's this kind of ongoing drama happening, a little family drama, and you're right in the middle of it, and you've already got a part based on the body you have and everything, and there's all these characters around, and you just have to sort of go along with the game.
Wait a minute, what's going on here?
So you don't know. This is our situation. Where do we come from? We do not know. That this knowledge was found out by bhakti yoga. By bhakti yoga, one can know the Lord, and by knowing the Lord as the Supreme is able to know everything else. One who knows the Supreme knows everything else. That is the version of the Vedas. I suppose this yasmin vijnate sarvam e vijnatam bhavati. Attributed to the Mundaka Upanishad 1.3. I sometimes looked at some of these references to the Upanishads, and the numbers are wrong, unless they're different versions, but that's what it says. Huh?
It tends to be both
the
northern and the southern.
Yeah, the different versions of it, so that could be
it.
So, because Krishna is that which, being known, all other things become known. So even the first spiritual master of the universe, Prabhupada calls him, was enlightened by the grace of the Lord. So So who else could attain perfect knowledge of everything without the mercy of the Lord? You may notice that the material scientists are also trying to figure out where it all came from. What is the source? What is the origin? Because it means it's in natural desire what's going on here. We're in this world, we want to put it in some kind of frame and make a coherent narration about it. We don't know what the master narrative is. Huh? So, and that all tends to be, of course, guesswork and everything like that. So he doesn't know where he is. He's kind of thrown into this world. And he doesn't know. The other thing is we don't know what we're supposed to do. Here I am, I have this life, what's it for? That we've got no idea either. I think we have the intuition that I got something important I'm supposed to do. And I don't know if it's to sell cars all my life. I mean, it seems like the things people want you to do, you know, what they seem to be like, to fall short of what you feel that's okay. It's there, you know. So it seems to me that Brahma is a kind of a prototype person of just the situation of anybody in the material world is being thrown in to existence, not knowing anything, and without any guidance or direction. No direction home, like a complete unknown. Like a rolling stone in the anthem of my generation. that's where you are. No direction home. Fortunately, we have one. So while thus engaged in thinking, he was Sahachintayan, he was considering this deeply. Where does everything come from? Where did I come from? What am I supposed to do? Remember, he feels that he's got to do something. I'm supposed to be doing something. And for some reason I'm here. What is it? It's clueless. Then he hears, Ekada, once upon a time, in the water, Upashranote, heard it nearby. Prabhupada says this is significant. Uttered twice these two syllables of the Sparsha alphabet, the alphabet of the consonants. The 16th letter, which is ta, and the 21st, which is pa. They don't say tapa, they say the two syllables, ta, pa. And it was repeated, ta, pa. That's it. Ta, pa.
Did he understand them?
Yes, he did. And both joined to become the wealth of the renounced order of life. Which is known as the of those niskinchananam, it is the wealth of those who have no wealth. It is the dhanam of those who own nothing. Prabhupada says here the brahmanas and the renounced order of life. It is their big asset, huh?
This common phrase that the austerity is the one of the Brahmins is coming from this, or it has some other sources?
I don't know what other source. I didn't find one. But maybe it has another source. Niskinchananam dhanam vidu. Know what has the. The dhanam, dhanam is wealth, and niskinchan, those who have nothing. Or without anything.
Okay. Can I ask a question about the Lord Brahma? I've heard another reading later on in the Bhagavatam that our Lord Brahma is eternally Lord Brahma. That even when he goes to the spiritual world, his swarup is that of Lord Brahma.
I don't know if that says so. Yeah.
You read that in Bhagavatam?
Yeah.
You know where?
No.
Are you sure you read it in
Bhagavatam? I'm reading it in the Bhagavatam.
At the end of the universe, when he gets and he serves Kama Dakshai Vishnu there as Lord Brahma. And then the next expulsion or breathing of Mahavishnu, he gets born there as Lord Brahma.
Well, we'll check that out.
Okay.
We'll check out that rumor.
Okay.
It's in the Bhagavatam, you ought to be able to, you know.
My understanding, there's an archetype Lord Brahma, which is when there's no jivas qualified to accept the post of Brahma, then Vishnu accepts the post of Brahma through this archetype Brahma. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we'll get on with the Brahma esoterica later. So this tapa penance from the very beginning of the creation, first adopted by the Supreme Spiritual Master. He's using these words like Supreme Spiritual Master Paroguru from the previous verse. So it says it came from near the water. So Prabhupada says this, what he did is he went down within the water to find out the means and source of his lotus feet, the lotus seed. So to say lotus seed. So you say lotus feet. It's a lotus seed. It seems he climbed down the stem, and got in or near the water, but was unable. He failed to find out where it comes from, which would indicate that by our own endeavors to discover these things, it won't work. But he heard these words, he heard the word tapa, twice. Now, taking the path of tapa is the second birth of the desiring disciple. Because this is the second birth. And he uses this interesting expression, I think twice, this desiring disciple, the desiring devotee. So that there is a, here means a desire, a sincere desire for, even though it may be inarticulate, you don't know quite what you're looking for, nevertheless, the desire is sincere for transcendence, self-realization. Calls him the desiring disciple. The word upashrinot is very significant. It is similar to upanayana. You know the meaning of upanayana?
Sacred train.
Yeah, it's called. It's the process of initiation. But the word upa, the prefix means near. So he probably says bringing the disciple nearer to the spiritual master, the path of tapa. So it means this coming close. Do you know the upanaya, what it breaks down?
The literal etymology?
Yeah.
Ni is to lead.
Ni
is to lead or to
lead.
So to bring near.
To bring near. That's the real meaning, just to bring near. They also say this is one idea of what the word Upanishad means too. Come close to here, to come near the spiritual master. So when he says he heard with his Upashinod, he heard nearby. This is indicating, in a somewhat subtle way, by this use of this word, that he was initiated. Because, so Brahmaji was thus initiated by Lord Krishna, and this fact is corroborated by Brahmaji himself in his book, the Brahma Samhita. So this is where he says, where he takes on the Brahma Samhita, where he sings in every verse, Govinda Madhi Purusham Tamahami. So, then, thus Brahma was initiated by, and here he says, the Krishna mantra. I don't don't know if he's referring to his book, Brahma Samhita, or this text, but it says here the Krishna mantra. By Lord Krishna himself, and thus he became a Vaishnava, or devotee of the Lord, before he was able to construct the huge creation. It is stated in the Brahma Samhita that Lord Brahma was initiated unto the 18-syllable Krishna mantra, which is we generally accepted by all the devotees of Lord Krishna. We follow the same principle because we belong to the Brahma Sampradaya. Now, in the here it is. Here's the account from the Brahma Samhita. On coming out of the lotus, being guided by the divine potency, Brahma turns his mind to the act of creation under the impulse of previous impressions, but he could see nothing but darkness in all directions. Then the goddess of learning, Saraswati, the divine court consort of the Supreme Lord, said thus to Brahma, who saw nothing but gloom in all directions, O Brahma, this mantra, this word vis, which is an abbreviation for vitilage, and is to be read as namely, if you ever run across it. It's old-fashioned, you don't see it anymore except in Prabhupada. I mean, just when you have seen this V-I-Z, say namely, this mantra, namely, and here it is, Prim Krishnaya Govindaya Gopi Jana Balavaya Swaha, will assuredly fulfill your heart's desire. Now, the promises we do this, that when the devotee receives second initiation into Gayatri mantras, they also get this mantra, which because it's 18 syllables is not Gayatri. Gayatri has 24 syllables. That's why we're speaking it aloud. But there's a good discussion in the Chaitanya Charitamrita Prabhupada about this 18 syllable mantra.
This is Gopal mantra?
I guess is it called the Gopal mantra?
Yes.
According to Prabhupada, there's three names of Krishna: Krishna, Govinda, and Gopijana Balabha. And they indicate, actually Krishna indicates Madan Mohan, Govinda indicates Radha Govinda, and Gopijana Balabha Radha Gopinath, the three deities of the Gaudiya Vaishnavas who preside respectively over Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana.
Same mantra was given to Gopi Kumar.
Huh?
The same mantra was given to Gopi Kumar.
I don't remember. Was it?
I can't remember that. I'm asking.
I don't remember.
That's what I'm going to go about that information.
So there's this is Brahma, this account of this this incident where the goddess Saraswati was really Krishna's energy of knowledge gives this his Jnana Shakti or his Samdhi Shakti gives this mantra. O Brahma, do thou practice spiritual association? Notice this. Now this is interesting. Tapas tvam tapa etena tava siddhir bhavishyati. Here it's spiritual association by means of this mantra, then all your desires will be fulfilled. Anyway, that's the account there. So here somehow or other he gets initiated by this mantra. And Prabhupada here, now this is very important. We follow the same principle, because we belong to the Brahma Sampradaya. The community. Sampradaya literally means community. Samprada. It comes together. Directly in the disciplic chain from Brahma to Nard, Nard to Vyas, Vyas to Madhva Muni, from Madhva Muni to Madhavindrapuri, from Madhavindrapuri to Ishwarapuri, from Ishwarapuri to Lord Chaitanya, and gradually who is Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, our Divine Master. Now listen, he says what says here. One who is thus initiated into the Siddhic succession is able to achieve the same result or power of creation. That's what he says. Chanting of this holy mantra is the only shelter of the desireless, pure devotee of the Lord. Simply by such tapasya or penance, the devotee of the Lord achieves all perfection like Lord Brahma. So you can see, Prabhupada wants to make it clear that Brahma is the prototype. He comes in the world, he's confused, he can't find his source, he doesn't know what he's supposed to do. Fortunately, by the grace of Krishna, he receives enlightenment. Not only does he see the Lord, but he knows what to do. And this experience, which we read about here in the other version in the Brahma Samhita, this is by the founder of our sampradaya. He's called the first guru of the universe, the supreme guru, because he's the first. What a parampara is supposed to do is really become a system by which spiritual potency is transmitted from one generation to the other, so that each generation can have the same experience. That's what it's really about. The word parampara, do you know what it means literally? It means one after another. Therefore, Prabhupada says chain, just like a chain, is one after another. And a chain becomes broken when it's the living spiritual energy stops being conveyed. Then people may go through the rituals, they may say the words, but there's no potency. You're just going through the motion. But in the parampara, we have two things. Not only is the knowledge that descends conveyed by the parampara, but the second thing that's conveyed by the parampara is the process by which we can realize that knowledge. We can apply it so that we become fit to be, take our place in that chain. To receive the knowledge, to have realized knowledge, and to convey the same energy on to the next generation. That's what parampara is. So we have this primordial Brahma. There's his experience. Then we get at different times the experience of other people. In the parampara. For example, with Vyas, it's described how he saw the Lord with his energies. He had a direct vision like that. And then, of course, with Mahaprabhu, and before him, Madhavendra Puri, these things are given to us. So that's really what the parampara is about.
Is it that Brahma is actually the original guru for all the sampradayas? Because
for what?
Well, for all, because Madhva, isn't Madhva like our specific?
Yeah, he's our sampradaya, the charaka.
Isn't he? Because there's four of which, he's Radha, Jaya, etc. I was just thinking maybe Brahma is actually the origin
of other sampradayas. Well, they don't trace them back. They trace one back to Lord Shiva, to Sampradaya.
Shiva, the Kumaras.
The Kumaras and Lakshmi Devi.
It can be said that they all get the Vedas somehow originally through him, but that the specific teachings of that sampradaya don't come from him directly.
See, the sampradayas have their particular characteristics. The Brahma Sampradaya, according to Prabhupada, I don't know where he says this in a purport, is the Sampradaya of the book. You see, Brahma's got a book in his hand, right? Representing the Vedas. Now, those days it wasn't really. But it's the Sampradaya of the book, and Prabhupada says the Brahma Sampradaya is noted for literary production. Whereas the Sri Sampradaya has opulent temples because they follow the goddess of fortune. So they have their little specialties. So he says here, one who's thus initiated is able to achieve the same result of power of creation. Do not think that this is an exaggeration. I think Prabhupada said what he says he means. It may not be our job, may not be our assigned task to create a universe, but there's something that we're supposed to be doing here. And to find out what it is and discharge it fully, that we can have the power to do by the grace of Krishna. What are you going to do?
That's the question.
Well, this,
distribute books.
This second line, changing of this mantra is the only shelter of the desirous pure devotee of the Lord. What it means, the only shelter.
What he means to say by this is that what does the mantra mean? Well, it means these three deities. What do these three deities mean? A mantra contains a lot in it. So by taking this is my only shelter, it pretty much includes the whole process of devotional service, everything else.
So, but it means that without this mantra one can also do, or only with this mantra one can also do.
For those who are in the Brahma Sampradaya, he says here, where is it? Where is this? Is the only shelter of the desireless pure devotee of the Lord. To me, what Prabhupada is indicating, he says, with this idea that one chants one's mantra, whatever it may be, as one's only shelter. Meaning I don't take shelter of anything else. I don't think it means to exclude other processes of devotional service, but merely that one should have no shelter outside of the practice of Krishna consciousness. You're supposed to have Eka Manasa, you know, single-mindedness, Eka Sangha Manasa. Right.
Yeah. Regarding the holy mantra, that's initiated in the Pacific succession. It's referring to, specifically to Gayatri Mantra, not Harinam.
Yeah, it's referring at least to this particular mantra in this context. It does. Yeah. It does. But, you know, let's face it, Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Balabha is also Harinam. It is specifically meditating on the name, these three names of Krishna. Sometimes Prabhupada said like that. What was the mantra that Mahaprabhu chanted? The problem is that this is another way of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, right? There may be various ways of chanting.
Uh-huh. This thing as far as the mantra being the only shelter reminds me of the Vihabharatamita. It seems that Prabhu Kumar is always, wherever he goes, he's taking shelter of his mantra, and by the end, he ends up in the Loka. thing that characterizes, like, at this stage of this journey is the one thing he's holding on to.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. That's what they mean. It's that kind of single-mindedness of purpose. So then, we should take a break. It's a little late already. Should we skip it? I mean, we need a little break.
If anyone needs a break, say aye.
Okay, we'll take a little break.